Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and it's time to discuss the offense, as much fun as that will not be, against the Bengals in this Week 13 loss. Joining me to do that is Jacob Abuspitan. Jacob, thanks very much for joining me. First of all, you come from my experience from meeting you is on Reddit, a great community over there. But do you want to talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, I definitely appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I love talking about football. Reddit's been great for me as well. I'm on a few different places, Reddit, Discord. Both have been really great areas of discussion, but Reddit does seem a lot of times to have a very large community and lots of discourse and discussion. So it's always great dropping in there.
Lots of different opinions. There's a few years ago, I thought it was mostly Buck Allen memes, it seemed like, but it seems like the quality of conversation is quite good right now. And so I'm enjoying my time over there. Anyway, the Ravens lose a critical divisional game, an unfunny comedy of errors, losing the turnover battle 5-1, 5-0 for a lot of the game, or anyway, for some of the game before Travis Jones got one back late for the Ravens. This is a game where I don't think you can blame the weather. There was a little bit of wind, but I don't think that was what was bothering Lamar Jackson in this one. It was not the offensive line play, and we're going to get into that later. So it's really Lamar and the pass catchers letting the team down. The pass catchers after the pass, and Lamar on the passes themselves.
Yeah, I'm actually really it's hard to sit there and say that they had a great night. Unfortunately, you know, but we did have some interesting usage of players, and I was excited to see the offense doing some certain things like spreading the ball out. Like we had a couple times that Ali went out and actually, you know, was on the boundary. So it's something new that we haven't really seen a lot that I'm excited to see if they can maybe, you know, expand on that a little bit and give us some more options.
Yeah, it would be nice. They didn't. I don't think they made maximum use of the running backs, but Justice Hill out has created some new challenges for them. And Ali was a big part of the solution this week. And honestly, I would not have bet on it because it's not something he did particularly well in college. But he was a really good pass blocker in this game, and he was on there. I think he had, as we scored it, 8 pass blocking snaps between sets and chips. I know that if you're looking at PFF, you may see some number like 4. And they don't count them exactly the same way I do. They basically count set blocks, but they also include ones that if there's a penalty on the play, they'll still score it. But I had him for 3 sets and 5 chips, I believe, was the number. And he looked darn good. In fact, had some bone-jarring chip blocks he threw in there.
Yeah, I think chips are really important for this offense. I mean, obviously, the Lions had its struggles over the year. And surprisingly, both Stanley and Rosengarten are both left on an island at a slightly higher than average rate. So they're not getting as much help throughout the year. So this may be a solution to kind of bolster their line a little bit, especially in cases where I think that right side of the line, especially with Rosengarten, is really struggling on stunts. A lot of people are you know, marking Falele down for some of these pressures, or, you know, seeing these pressures, but a lot of times on these stunts, and don't always understand how those stunts are supposed to be picked up. And having that back in there can probably really help. You know, it is always surprising that Henry, being the big guy that he is, that, you know, isn't more vital on those pass sets. But it was definitely a surprise to see Ali being that much of a contributor to that aspect of the game.
Yeah. Yeah. The you bring up an interesting point with the island usage of offensive tackles. That's not entirely up to the offense. The offense doesn't just get to decide we want one more, but it's often up to the defense. The defense decides how many people do we want to crowd the line of scrimmage with? Do I want to show, you know, double A gap mugging of for my linebackers, that their first movement of those guards has to be to the inside to try and pick those guys up, and then you may leave your tackle on an island. It's just a lot of things there. Football is an interactive sport. There's an offense and defense component to it that it's not just the offense deciding whether or not they want to give help or not. All right, let's get back to other things. Lamar looked a little more mobile in this game, I thought. The Bengals backed off from crowding the line of scrimmage. In fact, they used one of the lowest totals of pass rushers per play at 4.34 for the game. That said, The Ravens had an opportunity for misdirection in this game, and I wouldn't say they really used it extensively. Did a little more running with Lamar, which is naturally, if you're going through any kind of read point with Lamar, then you're creating some misdirection value for your running back. But I didn't feel like they went off on that.
No, I mean, they definitely, like you said, there was more of an opportunity or more of an attempt, I should say, to use that. I agree. I think he looked a lot more mobile this game. It was really showing in the first part of the game, probably through the first quarter. Later through the rest of the game, though, there seemed to be a little bit more of a timidness to, you know, him using that part of his game. And that which is understandable. I mean, tons of turnovers, you know, they probably just kind of maybe getting inside his head a little bit. But for the most part, I totally agree. I think he was able to move around a lot more. He was creating, you know, a lot more space in the run game for himself. But you're right, it didn't really translate much to the run game. And I know it was kind of noted that they did kind of start doing a little more point of attack to try to get that. But I think they really should lean more into the zone. I feel like Henry still does benefit from that. But as far as the pass protection and creating, you know, that area of opportunity, it does seem like there's an attempt, but you're right, it didn't really pan out as well.
Yeah, the zone versus gap is going to be, I don't want to re-go to Sanskrit every single time we have the discussion here, but I agree. I mean, he's a good cutback runner. He had some good cutbacks in this game. The first long TD run, he did a good job of picking his hole, and not only picking his hole in, you know, at the line of scrimmage, but picking his hole in level two. He actually had a really nice cutback there through traffic. That was, I thought, very impressive. But giving him that opportunity should really pay off. It hasn't really always this season, and hopefully Henry himself is not entirely to blame here. I'm sure he's not, but it just hasn't been as good this year in terms of picking the right hole. The other side of that coin is you play more point of attack football, which has been valuable against teams that have really crowded the line of scrimmage. Now it's not what the Bengals did. They went with fairly modest numbers in the box. It was sometimes seven, it was sometimes eight, but the Ravens' ability to play point of attack football is probably less valuable with that being the case. They had much more good second level flow to the ball than other teams have. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, for this game, yeah, they definitely weren't as crowded. I mean, traditionally through this year, if I recall correctly, I mean, Henry's faced pretty much the most men in the box throughout the entire year out of all like the top running backs. I think the next closest person is, I think Cooks over in Buffalo. But you're right. I mean, when they're not crowding the line, that really should give us the advantage to use that misdirection and kind of have the line get the opportunity to get those angles. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we looking at the line, and I'll be the first one to say, like, anyone that talks to me, I'm very biased to the line in general. I was a lineman myself, so I really give those guys a lot of leeway, but they just haven't really shown, especially at the two guards and even with Rosengarten, able to kind of take advantage of that, because I don't know if they have that mobility as a whole, but I still would like to see them try it more, especially in the game where they're not filling that box and they're giving that opportunity to create those angles, to create those big plays, you know, and especially if Lamar is looking a little bit better, a little bit healthier as he has the last, you know, versus the last few weeks.
It's an interesting point. We're going to get more into the offensive line in the second half of the show. I know a lot of the mailbag questions were directed at the offensive line, at Emory Jones, a lot of the new opportunities that were there this game and how they went. I promise you great detail on that in the second half of the show anyway, when we get to that. We'll talk about the first quarter of the football game, because there was quite a swing of, I don't know if I'd call it momentum, I just call it win probability in the first quarter in several of the big plays. Obviously, the fumble gave the ball to the Bengals at the 2-yard line. They failed to punch it in, which was a big swing. The Ravens got a chance after an alternation of punts, gave the Bengals a second field goal. After they had an alternation of punts, and then they had the opportunity to go up 14-6. And they lost the ball going across the goal line with Likely, which was, I think, probably the game's single biggest play. There were a lot of bad plays for the Ravens in this game, but I think that was the single biggest play. Do you have another nominee for that?
I mean, if I had to pick something, I mean, it was great that the defense was able to recover on that first, sack fumble. It's hard to, like, it's really hard to blame Jackson in that situation. You're getting bared down so quickly. But I mean, you go back to the Bills game in the postseason last year, just that ball security really was fixed in the last few years. I mean, he hasn't had that same issue, and it's definitely reared its head a little bit last couple of years. But I mean, that fortunately did not translate into points, but it kind of led to, in my opinion, that regular, I guess you could say, like, attitude of like, okay, we got to recover when it's still a close game. You never want to have early turnovers. You especially don't want to have them in your red zone. So I do think that one was huge. But you could say the Zay one later. I mean, that kind of just put the bow on the game. And again, it's also disappointing with Zay to have those issues. And I know we'll talk about the skill guys later, but that kind of just has been indicative a lot of the season.
Been very tough. I've been very tough to see all the skill guys and the fumbles they've had. Lamar really hasn't been as big a problem this year with the fumbles as he's been in some past years. But other people like Derrick Henry with three fumbles in the first three games, and Zay Flowers and some of the other receivers have played a bigger role in fumbles. Certainly Mitchell's had a lot of trouble holding on to the football all the way through. And I don't know if he's turned the ball over. I don't think he has, but the ball's gone out of bounds at least once, maybe twice on him while he's been close to the sideline. You know, one thing I don't like to bring up on the show, I really like never to bring up if I can, is that the officials really played a role in this game. And it was a role that did not seem to go in the Ravens' way very often. It's hard for me to pick the plays, but if you look at it, they had at least four plays where I thought there was a significant role. They had the OPI on Flowers, which I don't think was any worse than the non-OPI call on Chase on the right sideline. So pretty similar plays. Maybe we hit on that one first.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing for me on that play was, you see this every week. And the biggest thing I think on that was is that Zay didn't really use it to create separation. With the Chase one, I mean, obviously you have your rose-colored glasses on. You can kind of make that argument that he did. But either one, yeah, I think they looked very similar. And, like, receivers can hand fight. I mean, that's just part of the game. They're allowed to put hands on each other against the defenders, but there wasn't a creation of separation, and it was a huge call in that moment. I mean, that was probably outside of the Likely reception that ended up in a fumble, unfortunately. That was probably one of the biggest plays to really get the passing game, more involved, and it felt like it's unfortunate because it really did feel like if you take those two things away, I mean, this is a pretty good statistic game overall. For the passing game, I know we did have some missed passes that really should have been completions, but for the most part, the game should have been an effective offense, at least for the most part in the passing game, that was completely wiped out by essentially two plays.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel like with two turnovers, the Ravens probably could have been in this ball game, not with five, obviously. To go on to another play that was not particularly meaningful, but I think was called incorrectly, was the NZI call. I thought it was pretty clearly an NZI on Murphy, who was in the zone. I looked at it in slow motion. I mean, I think the rule has got to be when they're both in the neutral zone and one appears to be, it's the other thing that was very damning about it was there's two Ravens players who reacted to it at the same time. They're not reacting to some stimulus independently and each being off early, unless it's a snap count mistake where the center forgets. And then I'd expect all the linemen to basically have the same problem. I just don't see how that couldn't have been initiated by Murphy. And then the Bengals, were pointing and whatnot, and the officials somehow came to the conclusion that was not an NZI. Look at it a couple of times. Tell me what you think. But what were your thoughts, Jacob?
So, I mean, if we're giving the benefit of the doubt to the officiating in this case, you know, they're really keying on Voorhees kind of having a small rock. You could make that argument at the end of the day. You know, he did have some movement. But, I mean, we're talking about a defensive end, you know, on the other side of the line and coming into the neutral zone. So it's one of those ones I think each, you know, each fan base can make their argument for it. But, you know, you're right. If you're in the neutral zone while that's happening, you're in the neutral zone. That's literally what the, you know, the penalty is, you know, neutral zone infraction. So while I understand the viewpoint of Voorhees was moving a little bit and maybe the defender was keying off on that, it's just logically and, you know, common sense, it doesn't really seem like that's the likely scenario that happened. Yeah, and like you said, fortunately it wasn't a massive effect, but there's still kill drives, you know, overall that still puts you back behind schedule.
Yeah, we saw what it did to Minnesota in the game against the Ravens. Okay, the last play where just an enormous impact on the Ravens was the tuck play. And I you know, one of the things that really bothered about me is I know the officials that come on tend to have a pretty significant bias to say the officials were right. There's just a bias for that. And so he's trying to look at it and call it in the way that he thinks the officials saw it to make the call he made. And then he's describing the thing exactly as they're replaying on the screen and exactly wrong. You know, saying the ball was, you know, the ball is basically all the way down. Well, the ball isn't. The ball leaves his hand at a 45 degree angle to the ground. You know, it wasn't anywhere close to all the way ball pointed down when it left his hand. That really tightened my colon.
Yeah. Again, it's one of those things where it's right on the line, depending on how you want to view it. You know, ever since they got rid of that tuck rule, and it really allows the officiating to make that determination that the quarterback is no longer attempting to move forward with the throw. And I mean, it's subjective at that point, and you know, you're going to be left to the devices of the officiating at that point. We may touch on it later, but I think the more important part of that play, though, is I'm wondering what the thought process on that, you know, that hesitation by Lamar was, because clearly he's trying to hit Zay, what it looks like, you know, over a long dig route. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, I'm wondering what it was that went through his mind that kind of had him to have that hesitation. But for the penalty for itself, yeah, it's we see it again every week. You're going to get a different call on that. For what it's worth, Gene did disagree, I think, on the Zay OPI, if I remember correctly, but I might be remembering wrong. But I believe he actually said that he was against that call. So occasionally you get one from the broadcast booth on your side, but unfortunately didn't play out in the field.
Yeah. All right. Things are changing now for the Ravens after this loss. They're now just a marginal divisional favorite, or even a plurality favorite only. Or a small plurality underdog if you're looking at the FTN playoff odds, where they're down to 46.4% to win the division, and the Steelers are slightly higher and a much higher chance to make the playoffs because they've got a better wild card chance. But the Ravens are down from 77.3% a week ago, as the gamblers call it, to 60% implied win probability, and that's using the best odds on all four teams as of right now. And that is a big hit from that one game to their probability to win the division. They've lost essentially their easiest, quote unquote, of their remaining six games they had. I think that's probably accurate too, to say it's their easiest, even though Burrow was back. Where were you on that?
I think you guys actually really had a great discussion about this last week, and how this, you know, how this team's viewed by the odds makers versus DVOA and everything. Ultimately, you know, we have to look at the Steelers. We have to look at the remaining schedule. And I really do think that the odds makers are kind of seen as a toss up, because the whole division obviously is not where it's supposed to be, you know, based on the historical precedent. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Joe Burrow coming back in is kind of throwing it, you know, something in a little bit of a wrench in there as well, because we still have a game against them, even though they've finished their two games with Pittsburgh. So it makes sense. I mean, it does make sense to you know, reduce the overall percentage. But I think what you probably have to remember is that we're reduced based on our schedule at this point, like our win-loss ratio. Overall, though, it's anyone's division still, you know, and that does include the Bengals. I mean, they theoretically could win out. We could drop a few games. Steelers could drop a few games. I think if we split, that gives the Bengals an opportunity as well. So it definitely makes sense. But I do think the odds makers still believe in Harbaugh. I do think they believe in Jackson. So I honestly think that 60% is probably a good number, just given the state of the division as a whole. But it's going to really be decided over the next 3 weeks. You know, that's really going to be the big aspect, is how we come out after these next three games.
Right. And the next one more than any other, but they really need to win these next two in a lot of ways, because they have to seal up the best division record by doing that. Otherwise they'll have to go into Pittsburgh and potentially, if they lose to Cincinnati, but they win both Pittsburgh games, certainly possible they can get there that way. But it's not going to be an easy path, because they'll have to beat Pittsburgh twice. Right now, so far, the Ravens haven't proved the ability to beat a good team, period. I'm not overall too concerned about how the gamblers have things relative to the modelers. I think the gamblers generally, those markets tend to be more efficient. And the modelers can tend to miss something in their markets. And by the way, the really good, sharp modelers are included in those gambling markets, because they're basically saying, I'll take the other side of that wager, just because, you know, a million people think that's right. My $1 million think that's not right. That's, you know, that's how you operate as a sharp. You don't care about the count of idiots measure of things. The markets are dollar weighted. That's true of all markets, by the way, folks, stock market, everything. So it's, you know, you see those kind of inefficiencies and you hit them. There is one thing. This is actually a very real thing that I'm eager to see if in 2026 this happens. The new gambling law, which makes only 90% of your losses deductible and 100% of your wins taxable, may actually change how many sharps and how many dollars there are from sharps in the markets, and may create less efficiency in betting markets. It's going to be a fascinating study if that happens. It's probably worth its own show or four next year to talk about that exact thing, because it's going to be a terrible year to be a gambler you're going to have to win a much higher percentage of the time. We've been through that on a separate podcast already, but it'll be interesting to see if the sharps react to it in the same way and have less action totally in those markets, which then could create less efficient markets. So I'll be interested to see how that goes. All right, let's get on to some more of the football from this last week here. The Ravens, obviously, it was a game of progressively kind of digging themselves a bigger hole with more turnovers and then some offensive inefficiency as well. They weren't perfect by any means on third down. I think they might have been 3 of 10 for the game or something. They had an incredible streak in the first quarter. They had 7 consecutive plays lost to start the game, and then they had 13 consecutive plays won. They should have taken over that game with 13 consecutive defensive wins. That's an unbelievable number. That's basically enough to put the other team out 4 straight times and 3 and out. And they basically did that. Although they started from the Ravens 16-yard line, they got a 3 and out from there to force a field goal. Then they got a 4 and out for no points from the 2-yard line. And then they got a 3 and out. And then they got not quite a 3 and out, but they got the other team to 3rd and 11. They got the Bengals to 3rd and 11. And then they converted that, which sucked. But during that time, I mean, the Ravens should have completely taken the game over.
Yeah, it was pretty unfortunate. I think I took some time to look in, looking at some of the Bengals drives. I think 4 out of their 6 field goals, you know, net, they had a total net yards of less than 30 yards. I mean, we're talking about not even getting, you know, more than 2 first downs, unless there was a big play. So 1 or 2 first downs. There's definitely an ongoing issue with the team, even when it's been well over the years, that it does seem like it kind of misses that killer instinct of just stepping on the opponent's throat. Like it even at our best football, it's always felt like, can we just soundly beat them? We're the better team. We can go ahead and just take care of them. Game's over, you know, good to go. Have Jackson sit down the last quarter. There's been a lot of struggle over the years. You know, this isn't something that's unique to just now, of not being able to really grind out those wins that are close. But the silver lining is they have been doing that to a degree this year in their wins. Unfortunately, as you said earlier, they just haven't been quality opponents. So you kind of want to, you know, lean back and forth to, you know, how meaningful that is. But this game in particular, I mean, every opportunity, you know, the defense did a great job for the first three quarters. And then, you know, something we'll touch on later is the snap counts and total plays. It all falls apart, you know, at the end when we just don't end up having that killer mentality. And again, it definitely feels like the team as a whole kind of gets inside of its own head and doesn't just play the basic game. I do feel it's been better. I got to give Monken credit that I at least did see, again, some variation this week, again, with Ollie going out to the boundary, even if he wasn't thrown to, you know, Mitchell was put in a few times and they did try to get him the ball a little bit more. So there's definitely an effort that's being made. It's just, there isn't really the nastiness about the team that I would like to see, especially with like what really should be a talented roster. I mean, this should be one of the best rosters in the league, and it's just not living up to its full potential for the entire season. And it really shown, you know, this week when we kind of had that opportunity to, like you said, run away with the game and just didn't happen.
Now they shot themselves in the foot multiple times. I'm going to go the other direction though on one thing you said, because I think this, I wouldn't say in past seasons this was a problem for the Ravens. The Ravens, generally speaking, have been probably the best team in the National Football League at absolutely stepping on the throats of their opponents to build up big leads. And it's evidenced in the fact that since Lamar's rookie season, since the beginning of the 2018 season, they have by far the best point differential of any team. And you know, they've been able to basically destroy other teams most of the time. Now, have they let some leads get away? Yes, they have let some leads get away. And I know people would point to that when I say it's not really true. But on the other hand, you know, the point differential itself speaks to it. And they've played up to their point differential from a Pythagorean perspective overall. It's just the Chiefs and the Steelers in particular, them being in the division, have done much better than their expected record based on their point differential. So those non-sustainable records that they have are the ones that people want to throw in your face. It's kind of like the other thing that bothers me a lot is when we talk about franchise building strategies, people will always point out the successful adaptation of what I consider be a suboptimal strategy and say, well, look at these, this team won. I mean, what the Eagles have done, I would never do that to my franchise in terms of mortgaging the future. And it happened to work out for the Eagles to go $500 million in debt and win a Super Bowl from it. And has also worked for the Rams to trade away all their first round draft picks for a number of years and win a Super Bowl with it. I wouldn't go with either strategy. And if you look at the history of pro football and the teams that have done that, you know, it's the Saints trading all their picks for Ricky Williams. It's, you know, it's the Browns going $400 million in debt, but they're not the example because the Eagles are the example. At least be balanced in terms of your review of what's good and bad about this. I'm not talking to you, Jacob, obviously, but I'm talking to the general you out there who's listening to this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I love the Eagles, though, and looking at them as a franchise is because I a lot of times I see them as like a mirror image in a lot of ways about just the quality of the franchise, the way that they, you know, the front office runs. It's definitely a different method of how they approach becoming successful. But, I mean, you got to look at them. I mean, they've had three separate coaches now go to Super Bowls, you know, since Reed left. And I won't dive too deep into it because that's a whole can of worms with, you know, moving on from a coach and everything. But, you know, they've had multiple replacements for their head coach. You know, people thought they would be dead in water after Reed left. They had Foles able to come in and help secure a Super Bowl. So I definitely, I'm 100% on board with you. I don't like those models either. I don't like, you know, pretty much selling out in the hopes of that one year that it works out. But on the other hand, you know, we see the league adding more and more cap space. We see the league just really pushing to kind of, put more and more money into the opportunity for team building. And kicking the can down the road, like, you know, has worked for a few different franchises, mainly the Rams in Philadelphia. But I'm kind of like you. I do kind of like the long game a lot more. I'm a huge fan of DaCosta. I think I actually think, not to go too far in a tangent here, but I think the biggest issue that we've had with our current front office is that, unfortunately, DaCosta doesn't have a DaCosta. You know, we had a lot of really great years finding amazing talent. And, you know, DaCosta was one of those guys that was out there finding that talent, bringing it to, you know, Ozzie's doorstep and saying like, hey, you know, this is something we could look at. This is what my guys have found. And I think, you know, over the years, being a great organization, we've been poached a lot of front office talent. Obviously coaching talent, you know, losing McDonald was obviously a huge thing. So the franchise is definitely doing the right things. You know, it's coming to those moments. And this is what I'm talking about with the killer instinct. I think, like I said, we're far and beyond typically a better team. There isn't a lack of piling on teams. It's just, it does at times feel like it, that as culture-wise, the games that matter, they do sometimes seem to be susceptible to being punched in the mouth and not necessarily knowing how to put a counter swing back to that. But as far as the franchise and the way that they move forward with those drafts, I'm a big fan of it. I do think that we get a little bit too lost in the mid rounds. You know, we do pile picks and do try to get stuff back for our trades. But overall, I mean, I still think it's a top five franchise, at least, if not better. But I do know with this year, a lot of people are, you know, kind of questioning it, and it's not unreasonable for people to do that. But I'm on the same page that you are.
You should be skeptical all the time of what your franchise is doing if they're running the franchise optimally. I don't have any problem with that as a fan. What I do have a problem with is not really looking over a period of time to look at that success. And I also think I do have a very strong bias that it is wholly inappropriate to lose your season ticket holder base potentially over playing the roller coaster game of parity. And that's something that I really dislike. And the Ravens, just from a financial standpoint, they are shoved into a very small geographic place in the United States. They depend upon their season ticket holder base as much as any team in the entire NFL. There isn't some huge amount of Ravens gear buyers. They might have a few more international fans than other teams. I'm always disappointed that they're never on the list of teams that's really trying to aggressively market in other European countries, like or the Rams got China. I mean, how on earth did they get that all by themselves? I mean, what's going on here? You know, I know Japan and the LA teams are always going to be linked fairly closely because of Otani and for other reasons as well. But it doesn't mean we should cede those areas entirely to the West Coast teams, and we sure as hell should not seed Europe when the flight is not terrible, and you know there's potential fans from Spain or France or the UK or Germany. We should be aggressively pursuing those people. There's a lot of wealth in that area that the Ravens can't afford to let go to other teams.
I love the fan base as a whole, though. I mean, it's definitely one of the fan bases that probably has one of the biggest expectations of any team, mm-hmm. you know, outside of possibly currently, I should say, the Chiefs, Eagles, you know, those teams that have been in the mix. But, you know, you're talking about long-term success with the Patriots. They may have gotten back on top of it now, but with the Patriots' recent woes over the last few years, we're either second or first in like total wins since, you know, pretty much 2000. I mean, the team at the end of the day, the franchise is a model of continued success. And I don't think anyone can argue against that. But to your point about fans, I mean, you know, they got LJ, you know, that's going to bring people in.
Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, he's absolutely a lightning rod of a player in terms of bringing in fans from elsewhere. It's a great pick above and beyond his level of play on the field because of who he is that way. A great person too, which has been great. In terms of the fan base, I love our fan base too. But you know who else I really love? I love the Browns fan base. They are incredibly dedicated. They're so into their franchise. It hasn't led them to wins. So I don't think that, you know, a lot of this is based on the fan base. I think it's on how the franchise pursues additional fans. And that's where I think the Ravens, if I had one qualm with management, it's that because the Ravens franchise gets it like almost no other franchise in most other ways. I mean, in terms of how they run their training camp, and I have no idea what the total number is, but it wouldn't surprise me if they spend about $50 per fan for all of the 2,000 people per time they allow into Ravens training camp. It wouldn't surprise me if they spend maybe, you know, $2 million or something on Ravens training camp. It's a huge amount of security and parking and, you know, little kits they give out to and toys and all those booths they set up. And, you know, it's a pain in the ass to run training camp. And yet they do it because they think it's a great way to engender new fans for the team.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress. For a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
They have all these kits they hold out, and they, you know, all kinds of things they'll do for you from fan services if you just ask. Things they do, the organization really gets it in terms of being linked to the community and trying to adhere to new fans in a good way. I just wish they'd go overseas and get some of those fans. They probably looked at it and they probably said, for some reason, those guys just aren't as valuable to us. A guy sitting in Munich, even though he's going to be loyal to us and even though he's going to wear our gear, is just not as valued to us as somebody who might be a season ticket holder someday.
Yeah, I it's funny that you kind of mentioned the fan experience. You know, I've had the opportunity to go to a few games over the years. I'm actually ready to go to the Pittsburgh one on December 7th. I'm really excited about. But I do come from a family of Washington fans, and and as much as I grew up loving the franchise as well, just because of family, I can definitely talk to the differing experience. Especially, like I said, M&T is just an environment. You know, it's just an absolute environment when you go there. Doesn't matter if you're on the lower levels. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, in the nosebleeds. It's always been, it's just a great experience. And like I said, that's probably been the one of the most disappointing things this year is just to see the, you know, how dejected like a lot of the fans have been because of having a struggle this year. But yeah, I mean, Steve's a businessman, so I have no doubt that he's gone over every penny of what it would be, you know, of cost of bringing fans in overseas. But it's like you said, it's a small market. I mean, if you look at it, if I remember correctly, you know, Steve isn't really one of the big, you know, wealth number owners in the league, you know, so he tends to see him running it kind of as a business. And what I really love about him, and I do think sometimes may lead to issues, but I love owners that are not interjected into every aspect of
right.
what you see on the field. You know, I'm a big believer, you know, in having people in place to do their jobs and run a business successful. And he does a great job at that. Sometimes you like him to step in maybe a little bit more, but overall, you know, he does seem to do things right.
I think that is a great point. I mean, I think all the four silos really all report to him directly, but he will not touch anybody but the top of the silo. And I even don't think that he'd reach down to tell somebody how to do something differently. Like if he saw something he didn't like from the community services, Heather Darney, if there was something he didn't like about that, he'd go through Sashi to make sure that he thought, is this really what we want to do? I saw this. I wasn't happy about it. Look, this is your area, but he would never bypass somebody to go down and talk to Heather directly and say, it's just not the way he operates. And it's his hiring and organizational structure that has been one of the real bedrock strengths of the Ravens. Honestly, since the franchise began, it's probably pretty good with Modell, but it's that much better with Bisciotti. It really it came out in the last Harbaugh hiring in terms of the way that was done. We got to get back to football here. Now, this is great, a great sidebar. This is what I talk about, rabbit holes. We love to go through them on the show. And after a loss, sometimes it's easier than talking about the game. We have to talk about Lamar's game a little bit. I won't get into the pass rush too much by numbers. I'm going to put the offensive line article up later tonight. Actually, it'll be up by the time this podcast is out. It'll already be up there. You can take a look. But there wasn't any particular number that the Bengals were rushing that was more successful. But they did run 28 plays with a four-man rush. They gave up 6.4 yards per play, but had three sacks and five turnovers on those 28 plays. So that was certainly very effective. And when they had more rushing, they were probably just about the same amount of effectiveness in aggregate on a yards per play basis, but there were no sacks or turnovers with more pass rushers, which is a little bit interesting, but I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions from the numbers in the offensive line article.
I do think it's a little bit of a tidbit, or I guess a nitpick, I should say. Technically, like they're putting that sack, that fumble that he had, that he's untouched as a sack, which statistically, yeah, I mean, that's a sack, but that's unforced in my opinion.
Yep.
So I'm really looking at it more as like, you know, the two. And we got it, you know, you have to recognize, like I said, there wasn't a ton of additional pressure brought compared to a lot of the other games. So that probably factored into the pressure numbers and everything. But yeah, I didn't feel like I kind of agreed with what you said earlier. I don't really think it was weather. I don't really think it was too much on the O-line. It just, again, when things kind of went downhill a little bit, it just kind of seemed the things just weren't really connecting at that point. You know, it's hard to look at the game, you know, and just kind of see guys open for some reason, him not seeing them. And the guys he's normally connecting with, like Andrews, just not making those that connection between the two of them, because that's normally his guy. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about should we move forward with Andrews after this year or not, but regardless of what Andrews' play has been, the two of them still really shared a connection throughout the year still. You know, it's one of the reasons he has as many touchdowns as he does. But
we're going to get into a few of the misses in just a minute, and I also want to talk about the pressure next as well, because it was a mixed bag of pressure. It was definitely a mixed bag. They had pressure, but a lot of it wasn't on the offensive line, was how we really saw it. So I kind of want to go through that a little bit, and then we can maybe have come back to some of your thoughts on that if we can. The Ravens had 8 ample time and space opportunities in the game, 23%. So that's a little bit low, 28, 29%, kind of the bogey I'd look for in this day and age. Now, here's the bad thing. Lamar had 8 ample time and space opportunities in this game. The results of those 8 plays were incomplete, pass fumble for 43. So that's the pass to likely that was fumbled at the goal line. Sack fumble minus 5. Incomplete. That is unreal bad. I've never seen anything like that in terms of having 6 incomplete passes and 2 turnovers among 8 opportunities with ample time and space. You should get about 8.5 yards per play on those. In some ways, you can consider the likely pay a punt if you want to, even though it was on what, first or second down. It occurs was not the time to be punting, but that was just an awful set of plays when he had plenty of time. And we're going to go over those plays in a little more detail. Every ample time and space throw and every ball out quick throw that he missed, we've got a list of, we're going to talk about. There are 10 such plays that he missed on the play. It doesn't even include the sack fumble. It doesn't even include the pass that went for 43 and then likely fumbled. It includes 10 other times where he had an incomplete pass on one of those two. That's an unbelievable number for a 35 pass game to have 10 where you just leave throws on the field with either ample time and space or the ball out quickly. All right, going with one more here. So with 12 times, the ball was out quickly. He went 9 of 12 on those plays for 80 yards, 6.7 yards per play, 1 turnover. He had 15 pressures on which he completed 7 of 13 for 105 yards. He actually was quite good with pressure until you look at the 2 sacks and 2 turnovers. And anytime you get 2 turnovers on pretty much any number of plays, but certainly on 15, that's not acceptable. But the 7.0 yards per play is actually quite good. The average expectation would be 3.5 yards per play on such plays. And so very frustrating what ended up happening in terms of the routine. Overall, the pressure, by the way, pressure to ATS, not a good ratio at 15 to 8. No, you wouldn't want to start off that. But a lot of that was generated actually by the Bengals overloading and getting free runs on the quarterback. So they got a free run from a side. They got like 2 in a 3-play sequence from Geno Stone. And they had 5 in total that didn't involve the offensive line, including the sack fumble where likely, it's the interception, right? Where likely got pushed back into the quarterback, ball got tipped, and then it got intercepted in the secondary. So, not a fantastic day for the offensive line, but actually they were not bad, and it's going to kind of show up in the grades that their pressure numbers in particular didn't look very bad. Lamar didn't run the offensive line out of any pressures in the game, and I want to stop talking, give you a chance to respond in general to this because I know you were onto some things earlier, I think it's really hard for me to look past Lamar in this game in terms of blame. I mean, there's blame on the receivers and some of the things they do with the football after they caught it, but most of it is directly on number 8.
Yeah, I feel like there's been a very odd trend looking at your articles the last few years, the last few weeks, where we're getting some of the worst production in those ample times. And on Reddit, I know we've had a few discussions, and I'm starting to wonder. You know, obviously Lamar's ability to create time in the pocket, to extend plays, and really find those guys in those open windows is generally been unparalleled. You know, I mean, he's probably the best of the league, bar Allen and Mahomes. It seems like I've been very critical of Monken over the years, just really not having these scheduled type plays, and it seems like, for whatever reason, that just isn't the strength for Jackson to have those regularly on schedule, hitting the guy in the window on the breaking route instead of having that window be fully open and him buying the time for him to have that happen. I mean, he's generally always been good against pressure as well, which again, oddly makes the discussion weirder. But it does make sense. I mean, if you're getting pressure, that means that there's going to be guys open as a hot call to basically get the ball where the pressure is coming from. I do want to divert real quick, though. I You got to give the Bengals a little bit of credit here with their defensive coordinator. There was more than a few times that, you know, they really did have creative play calling in order to generate that pressure. I think the biggest one that most folks are going to immediately come to mind is late in the third quarter, where they had the edge rusher come off completely free and, you know, pretty much immediately get to LJ. But we, at first I was like, man, they must have clearly messed up on the slide protection. You know, I'm like, there's no way that should happen. Even me watching it. And then, you know, you watch the replay and it's like, no, they called the slide correct. But Bengals, again, just did a great job. They ended up rushing only four, even though they showed pretty much seven at the line. Mm-hmm. Again, just an absolute great call. And then the couple plays before that, or maybe in the play right before that, where a great tendency call, in my opinion. The team loves to run this bootleg, you know, inside the red zone. They do it, I don't want to say a ton, but often. And the Bengals call the cornerback blitz from the slot, where the Lamar is rolling out to the right side, and the cornerback's able to squeeze in between Rosengarten taking his step out and also Flelly also stepping out also, and just beats him with speed. And it's just, it was a good call. I mean, the Bengals have had a historically bad defense this year. And a big part of it, obviously, is their turnovers and penalties. But they did a fantastic job with the scheme and the play calling in this game.
Yeah. So the two plays you're talking about, I think, were actually consecutive. The first one, which is the second one you mentioned, was a 6-0 blitz, including the corner. That the guy was on that practice squad, Jalen Davis, not Jalen Armour Davis. Jalen Davis came free, and he beat Falele. So that was on him. But then the next play, they had a 4-3 blitz. So they had seven guys at the line of scrimmage, drop three, and they still managed to get Murphy on Likely, rolling right back into Lamar's face for the tip ball and the interception. That's unbelievable. And it was well schemed. They got Geno Stone free twice for in a three play sequence, as I mentioned before, in terms of getting him pressure off the edge directly. It was very well schemed. And in some ways, even though it wasn't showing cover zero all the time, there was some creativity that reminded me of that Miami game years ago, or even the game in Minnesota recently with Flores and really going after with a crowded line of scrimmage, in terms of dropping from the middle and still maintaining your overloads on the outside. It does mean you end up with a nose tackle in coverage somewhere out there in zone coverage, but you end up with still your overloads in good shape. One thing about having a nose tackle, by the way, in some sort of short zone coverage, there's no need to go very deep, because if anybody tries a shallow cross on you, that's within 5 yards. You'd go knock him into the other end zone pretty much if you want to. So anyway, you're 100% right on that, though, in terms of creativity, and it does deserve to be looked at. Lamar actually outperformed his opportunity set on the day, largely because of those results in pressure. And this is yards only, folks. And don't think for a moment I think this was good. But he had 223 net yards and 193 expected, 0.9 yards per play above expectation, and extremely little consolation for having five turnovers is the way I would put it. I don't know if you'd been plus 150 if it would have made up for five turnovers. It would have been really close at the best. Want to spend a few minutes, though, going over the 10 throws that got left on the field. And we'll just go through these fairly quickly in each case. And what I'm trying to do here is we don't use video on this. Obviously, we're using audio. So I'm trying to recreate the visual memory. So think back to the game if you haven't completely blocked it out, or you maybe were too drunk to watch it initially because of Thanksgiving or too much tryptophan. Let's go with that instead. I'll go through these plays one by one, and I kind of want you to comment on each, Jacob, as we go through. The first play came up in the first quarter with 1:53 left, second and 10. There was a ball thrown wide of Hopkins. It was about 8 yards between the numbers and left hash. He was covered quite tightly by 23. It's not Turner. It's the other guy, Dax Hill. And it looked like to me that Flowers was open on the opposite side of the field between the numbers and the right hash in zone.
Yeah, I mean, for that one, like I said, it just feels like he's trying to go to the guy that he trusts. For whatever reason, there's a lot of targets to Zay, but a lot of his routes that he did end up getting, you know, real chances are weren't really like his normal, you know, deep crossing routes or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's good to see some tight window attempts, but yeah, just off the mark.
Yeah, he trusted Hopkins, obviously. I don't have a problem. Hopkins has come through for the Ravens. Hopkins is one of the guys I still think is a single high beater because I trust him completely to go get the football outside the numbers where no safety will get there. It'll be a mano a mano with him and that cornerback, and I trust him to go get the football. We're going to get to a little bit of Tez Walker, though, in this game, and that was unfortunate that he left some throws on the field with him. First quarter, 1:50 to go, so it's the very next play. Ample time and space. The pass was high and out of bounds, 13 yards on the left sideline. It was to Flowers. There was no defender within 4 yards of him. Easy pitch and catch first down, just overthrew it out of bounds.
Yeah, same thing, just for whatever reason. Again, that kind of felt like it may fall into that timings and on schedule type throwing where – you know, he got out of his drop, went ahead and went to get the delivery, and for whatever reason just sailed it. I mean, there was a few sailed balls this game. Mm-hmm. So like overall, like that's one of those ones that you just kind of scratch your head at, because like I said, it's just like he's there, he's ready to get the catch. Like I said, no one's around him. You know, Zay's gonna make space, he's gonna get yards after the catch, and for whatever reason, just wasn't able to connect on it.
Yeah, the ball needed mustard on it was really what it needed. It almost looked like it was floated over there a little bit, but there was no pressure at all in the play, so there's really no excuse for it. We'll move ahead into the second quarter, 11:15. This one, a lot of people will remember and may even blame Mark Andrews for it. He was kind of like on a tight number two to the outside, and he's coming back for the football a little bit, and the ball was straight thrown well short of his depth on the field, and a little bit also outside of the space he was occupying horizontally on the field. So, you know, just not a good throw. And he ended up diving kind of diagonally back towards the sideline to get it. And it didn't really come particularly close to doing it. It was about 7 yards outside the left numbers. There was no defender within 6 yards of him. And in fact, if you look at it, Geno Stone fell down on the coverage early in the play.
Yeah, so that's probably the big one. Like you said, everyone kind of remembers. Sometimes with throws like that or in that scenario, Andrews sometimes I think might be one of the few players they kind of give the option, you know, the option routes to a little bit more. There's a lot of times that I feel like him and Jackson kind of have those moments where it's just, you know, outside of his fingertips. And that might be something that contributes to it. But yeah, he said he was completely left alone after Stone fell over. And maybe, like I said, one of those times you might want to attribute to excitement or just, you know, in that moment, you're like, wow, he's so open, I'm going to just get it to him so he can start getting up the field. But as you said, I mean, wasn't a full-on grounder, but it was well short of where Andrews was at the time. It was a good effort by Andrews. Like, that's always going to be a difficult catch. And, you know, you still want to see someone, you know, professional get those catches when they can. That's a big difference. But at the end of the day, you know, that's just outside that catch radius. It's a hard catch. And, you know, I talked about their connection earlier in the podcast. And sometimes, like I said, sometimes it just doesn't pan out that way. But again, looking at all of these throws that we're talking about so far, that, like you said, they're ample time, and it just doesn't quite seem to hit the mark. And I don't, looking at these plays, especially that one, that didn't seem like there was any rush in his mechanics. It's just the ball wasn't on the spot that it needed to be.
Move along here to quarter two, 9:52. We had a late quarterback hit after ample time and space, but he overthrew Walker 37 yards down the left sideline. And again, Geno Stone had fallen down in coverage. He was open by 2 yards over Stone. And if you remember the ball, that's one that Walker went up high for, did not have to be placed as high as it was. And in fact, he was more open at the point where Jackson threw it. And he could have seen what had happened to Stone at that point. And he rifled the ball, which was good because I was going to give Walker a good yard after catch opportunity. The other one to Walker later, if he had to get the right amount of air under the ball. But this case, it was well rifled. It was just high. And it was, I don't think it's fair to say that Walker should have had the ball. If he had made that catch, it would have been a fantastic grab going up high and securing it somehow. A big opportunity missed for a big play.
Yeah. I mean, over the years, like I think sometimes we've seen those type of throws be somewhat of a struggle. So that one's, I don't think is as surprising as some of the other ones like that we've talked about already. Like you said, another one's going to come up later where, again, it's just kind of lofted too much. Mm-hmm. So that one, I probably wouldn't have too much comment on. I mean, again, we've seen that over the years. Jackson it probably isn't the top echelon for the deep ball. Like I said, again, he normally buys that time and then allows the receivers to run under it. But that one, like you said, just placed a little bit too high. Again, you can't expect Wallace to obviously catch that. You would love for him to be able to, because I know a lot of people are really kind of high on him and some of the other guys that are buried in depth. And I know that would have went a long way to maybe giving him some more opportunities as well. But overall, I mean, that's one of those ones you don't want to quite call it a pitch and catch, but it is a standard NFL throw at the end of the day.
I don't blame Walker for either one of these plays. I would say this, neither one of these plays should hurt Walker in terms of getting more opportunities. They should be figuring out how to correct depth of the throws and trajectory of the throws to get them made. But the next one was Bateman, quarter two, 2:30 remaining. Bateman only had one target the whole day. This was it. Ball was out quickly. And Bateman had a wonderful situation that he created on the right sideline. And we talk about Bateman being the best route runner. What he did well on this play is he's on Dax Hill, who's a safety slash corner, not the fastest guy in the league. He wouldn't be a guy I don't think who could keep up with Bateman in a kind of a race if they ran side by side. But the ball was thrown. Bateman was about 26 yards, and he overthrew it in a way that I think is similar of some of the throws of to Bateman in years prior to 2024. 24, Bateman had a great year, but Lamar didn't seem to really have trust for him earlier in his career in the same way. Bateman did a great job of stacking Hill on this play. He basically had him left-laned on the was on the right sideline, but when I say left-laned, I'm describing a position where he's intentionally making it hard for the cornerback to get to either side of him. The cornerback did not have an easy path to inside position and didn't know where inside position even would be. But when he's in that position and he's stacked the corner, he's got a great chance to either make space to the sideline, make space to the post, or make space vertically directly. And he didn't do, Jackson didn't put him in a position to do any of those three things. Now there was help on the inside. So in my case, Jackson's got to go either 9 or 7 there. He's got to go to straight vertical or he's got to go to the corner, but he can't really go to the, I'd say it might be suboptimal to go to the post. There's more risk there, but he had two places to put the ball where there was like no risk at all. And he just overthrew it as opposed to, taking those options for perfectly good space that Bateman had set up.
Yeah. Well, if the story of Bateman, I mean, if Andrews and Jackson have, an almost psychic ability to work together, Bateman and Jackson are sending each other mixed messages. So with not very surprised in that scenario. I mean, it's very unfortunate because I agree with you. I mean, we see it in separation numbers. We see it all the time with Bateman that he really should be more productive than he is. But yeah, I think, air balls to Bateman is just about as common, it goes together just as well as pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving. For whatever reason, the two of them just don't have that chemistry. And they did hit it, like you said, 2024. It was a great year for me. It was really creating hope. But yeah, I mean, looking at that play, it's just kind of like, oh, all right, well, there's that one for the game,
Well, hopefully he'll be able to pull this together. The Ravens will have Bateman for three more seasons, 26 through 29. So they really need to get what they can out of him. And he's He's on a really nice contract. It's a team friendly contract, and it potentially is an outstanding deal for the Ravens. They just need to maximize it. Let's keep going here. We go to the second quarter, 36 remaining. Jackson stepped up, pump faked, and the ball was lost out of his hand for an incomplete that was ruled a fumble. Now, this is not technically an incomplete on the table, but it was a sack fumble on an ample time and space opportunity. I thought that it was just the wrong call, but in either case, it's an opportunity lost for the Ravens. I don't think we need to say anything more because we've talked about that play, and I kind of want to keep us moving here. Quarter three, 5:25 to go. There was a screen underthrown to Mitchell, short left. Bruce Arians had a term for this that I love. Instead of trying to throw him the ball, I tried to hand it to him. And that's exactly what happened. And Mitchell, there's no one close. There's no one within 10 yards. In fact, there's a great block in front of him from Andrews. He had one man to beat. And it's Keaton Mitchell against, I don't care who it was. You know, I think it was a linebacker, 42 or 49, one of those two guys. But, I mean, it would have been a very tough one and done there. That looked like it could have been a 30-yard play for Mitchell. And it's the kind of play that he just does not get back. There was no defender, you know, anywhere close and no reason to miss it. Ball was out quickly. And it's just, there was no reason for the ball to be missed. Anything to say about that one? Or
probably the most disappointing play for me the whole game, just because I've been really high on Mitchell getting more opportunities. You know, I do want him in the game more. And yeah, I felt the same way. I mean, there's nobody really in front of him, and we've seen what he's able to do with his speed and space. And it's just, it literally just kind of like threw my hands up. Like, you know, I don't normally get too emotional about the games, but I that was one of those plays. I couldn't believe that they missed on. And again, it's just everything just in these throws are feeling accelerated and unnecessary at times. But it's, on the other hand, I mean, we don't incorporate that stuff a lot. So it's not surprising to see, you know, a little bit of, you know, issues on those plays when it's not something we do a ton of. But yeah, I was so disappointed that, because I mean, there's no guarantee, but that felt like a house call in the making.
Yeah, it was definitely they had a lot of guys at the line of scrimmage, I think, on that. No, they did not, according to this. It was just a 4-0 pass rush. All right, I'll move on. The next one, and another disappointing one thrown to Wallace, is in the fourth quarter with 8:39 to go. Had an ample time and space opportunity. Wallace was open 45 yards down the left sideline. He had Dax Hill stacked again, but Lamar did not put enough air under the ball. You know, it's a play he's got to just throw longer, because Walker has all the speed in the world to throw under that. And you can see him losing to Dax Hill, which tells you that ball is not thrown with the proper depth right away, that he has to slow down to try and catch it. And then he'll manage to get his hand inside the catch point there. As they went to the ground, he pulled it loose.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of just discussed it on the previous Wallace one, so I don't want to rehash too much. But, you know, especially with in these moments right now, if we're giving any benefit of doubt, really have to take consideration of, you know, any possible you know, lower injuries that Jackson's dealing with right now as far as getting the ball down the field properly. But I mean, outside of kind of talking about that and maybe giving some credence to it, again, it's just needing to put the ball in the right spot, you know, because you do get a lot of the power from the throws, a lot of, you know, that that consistency of your throw using your legs. You know, Jackson has the arm strength to just toss the ball down the field, but you're never going to get that same accuracy and touch by pretty much arming the ball. But overall, just another miss.
Yeah, I mean, that's an argument I would take if it wouldn't happen on a ball out quick, because you don't throw a 45-yard ball on a ball out quick. About the most you can ever throw is right around 40 yards on a ball out quick, if you're doing the Steve Walsh hit him between 41 and 42 yards kind of thing. If you have a throw that long and it was ample time and space, that's just a direct miss from the pocket. There's not anything about that I can put on leg strength or whatever. I mean, he's got to be able to, his range has got to be significantly more than 45 yards. I would think it's over 60 that he could throw a ball normally with full confidence in stepping into his throw. He should have had it on this play. And it's a play where he could have lofted that ball significantly further. I think it could have been thrown anywhere between 2 and about 8 yards further, and Walker would have run under that ball and made the catch easily and had six. It's just
now, where was, if you don't mind me asking, where was the, I don't recall, where was Walker at the point that he actually attempted the catch?
Yes, good question. I will get that for you. It was 45 yards from the line of scrimmage and 8:39 to go in the fourth. Let's go right to it. I think people will have a memory of this. Great play by Walker, by the way. I just want to mention one other thing while I'm looking this up. He stacked the receiver, stacked the corner very well on that play. He like literally moved around him, and all of a sudden he's got the one lane on the road with making passing very difficult. Okay, so the ball was at the Baltimore 49. So it was at 43 yards. It was at the 10 that the ball was incomplete. Okay, so the ball would have been caught at that point and then pried free. I don't know exactly how the game book has measured that, whether that would have been 2 yards after the catch or right at the catch point. But it was a ball that if it's thrown at in front of him anymore, there's no way Dax Hill is making a tackle on that play after that. Yeah. All right, we'll keep going here. Quarter four, 5:01, another ATS throw. Jackson threw it out of bounds intentionally. We had Andrews open short about 5 yards between the numbers and the right hash. I wouldn't call this a big opportunity miss because there was late pressure developing and, in fact, a late quarterback hit by Osai on the play. But the bigger opportunity missed was hitting Bateman wide open deep about 17 yards. And it would have been right at the same level as the deepest defenders, and it would have been a possibility for a very big play. Bateman did a really nice job on that play too of coming back towards the ball, seeing Jackson's in trouble. So, you know, the relationship is not completely balanced in terms of how much each is helping the other. And Bateman did a really good job the first time of stacking the corner. The second time, he did a good job of coming back for the football. And Jackson missed him both times, which is unfortunate. In the second time, he missed him because he didn't see him, I think is reasonable, but it is what it is. A missed opportunity anyway in that play. Got one more to go. I'll just do this because we need to get through this first part of the show here. 4:54 to go in the fourth. He overthrew Flowers 27 yards down the middle. That was a ball through between four defenders in zone coverage, and there was a real chance of an interception on that play. So in a way, he's kind of lucky that he threw an up and down ball and it didn't get intercepted between layers there. On the other hand, he missed it very badly with ample time and space, and that was, again, frustrating.
Yeah, just looking, like I said, he probably looking just again to kind of get back in the game. He doesn't really do too many forced window throws like I said previously. But with that one, if I recall correctly, like you said, Zay had a little bit of space. It would have been a really tight window. If anything on that one, I would probably look back at the decision as a whole over anything because of the coverage. But like you said, fortunately, the overthrow did kind of help the situation in that regard. But again, just there wasn't a decisiveness in this game overall that probably led to some of these misses as well.
Difficult game, obviously. We heap the praise on Lamar every game when he overshoots the mark, but it's only fair in a game like this that was more or less on him and on a couple of different receiver mistakes that we talk through some of these problems, and obviously a big issue in this game. Jake, we're gonna have to cut off the first episode here. We'll talk about a few other scheme decisions. A lot of questions have come in about Ali and how much he was playing and some of the other things in terms of pass protection. We're going to get into that in the second episode. But first of all, tell us, where can people find you online if they'd like to ask you a question about football?
Probably my biggest presence is definitely going to be on Reddit. My handle is Spitan89, so Sbitan. 89, definitely cruising through on the Reddit pages quite often. Always, of course, feel free to message me. You'll probably see me oftentimes on Ken's reviews as well, now that he's expanded out there. But yeah, probably the best place to find me at this point.
All right. Reddit community, outstanding. Again, I'll mention a lot of high quality discourse there. And that's one of the things I noticed from you, Jacob, is right away is how high quality the interactions were. And I just happened to need somebody for this Thanksgiving Day to talk defense. I appreciate you jumping on short notice. And I'd love to talk to some other Reddit people who might be interested in that sort of thing. Normally, you go through a process where you're on a short first, but I could tell that you did an outstanding job in terms of the quality of the discussion we had. Other folks out there, thanks so much for listening. As always, hit us up with questions on hashtag Film Study Mailbag. I'm looking to expand my set of video shorts to answer more questions that way. I know a lot of the Reddit people have done a good job of taking some advantage of that, and I'd like to do more of those, probably put them out on YouTube, do a little bit more. My bent is to have 5 or 6 minute videos because I take a long time to be thorough explaining things. My wife, who was the originator of this new format, and other people have told me you need to create 30 to 90 second things and not, you know, bore people in the way you're doing here. I will try and do better. And I say that with looking at the clock here at 1 hour and 13 minutes on the first episode here. Jacob, thanks again for joining me.
Thank you so much, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.